Okay, so you heard the title. I'm going to talk about combining measurements and models in atmospheric physics. So the plan is to talk about data simulation, what is it, and then talk about recent advances in data simulation methodology, and then finally the new application, which is data simulation with a climate model. So what is data simulation? Well, I think of it as involving a cycle where there are two steps. You have an analysis step and a forecast step. So what is the analysis step? Well, we take a lot of measurements of the atmosphere, and they're distributed in some sort of irregular fashion in space and time, and they're imperfect. So we get observations that maybe we can represent like this in some sort of irregular pattern, but what we really want is the information of the observations on some nice, regular, physically consistent form, specifically on some model grid. And this process where you go from the information of the observations in some irregular distribution to the information of observations on some regular grid, we call this process the analysis process or the analysis step. And this field itself we also called an analysis. So why do people want analysis? Historically, the most important reason for doing an analysis was to get an initial condition for launching a weather forecast. But also, once you have an analysis, that represents your best estimate of the state of the atmosphere on some nice representation, well, then you can study that to understand more about atmospheric phenomena or atmospheric processes. Also, becoming more increasingly of interest is the monitoring, prediction, and estimation of atmospheric constituents. So, for example, at weather centers, what we want to work towards is being able to produce predictions of atmospheric constituents just as we now produce weather forecasts. And finally, once you have an analysis, then you can compare to, say, a new instrument, for example, a new satellite instrument, and see how well that measurement compares to your analysis, which contains information from your current observing system. And in the same process, you're also going to learn more about your analysis and about the model itself. So where do we get our measurements? Well, our measurements altogether comprise the Global Observing System, which is managed by the World Meteorological Organization. And they come on a variety of platforms. For example, we have the backbone of our system are these radiosonde packages. So they're in-situ measurements, and they're attached. It's a box which is attached to a helium balloon, and it rises up through the troposphere, and it takes measurements of temperature, moisture, and by tracking the balloon, you get horizontal wind components. We also have in-situ measurements from land surface stations and also on the ocean surface from buoys and ships. We have a lot of actually in-situ measurements of wind also from aircraft. We have also remotely sensed instruments coming from satellites, both polar orbiting and geostationary satellites. And most of these kind of measurements that go into our simulation system, operational ones, they are nadir sounding, which means that they're looking at the radiance at the top of a column of the atmosphere, like this. And finally, we also have things like weather radar. Now, all of this information is being collected continuously, and it's beamed back to our national weather centers. And our national weather center is called the Canadian Meteorological Center. And here's an example of some of the data that was used by CMC on Monday to produce our analysis at noon universal time. So here's the idea is to just give you a sense of the distribution of the measurements. Here's a distribution of the radiosonde measurements. These are great because they give us vertical information through the atmosphere. But in terms of the distribution, they tend to be in the northern hemisphere on the continents. Aircraft, again, the distribution is great over the U.S. and over Europe, where you get a lot of aircraft ascents and descents. Over the ocean, the North Atlantic, we get single-level data at cruising altitude, and you get a bit of the North Atlantic and a few other corridors, but a lot of the oceans are unobserved. Satellite data is, when you look at altogether, these are tracks from four different polar orbiting satellites in the four different colors here. And if you look at the ensemble that went into our system, the global coverage looks amazing. It looks pretty good. And you won't see it in this representation, but it's very good polar coverage. And that's complemented by geostationary satellites. We have five of them here. And you can see that their coverage is great over the tropics. So that looks like a lot of data, and that's only a tiny part of the amount of data that we're assimilating. So what you can do to get an estimate of the total amount of data that we have is put it all together in terms of the number of reports you have times the number of variables you're observing times the number of vertical levels that you're getting. So I did this in a very, very ordered magnitude, very rough way, and this calculation is representative of the system about 8 months ago. And if you do that, you find that we have about 1.6 million different pieces of observations. But the current operational model is a grid point model, and it has, in terms of grid points in the horizontal, 800 by 600 grid points for 58 vertical levels and four prognostic variables, so two wind components, temperature, and moisture. And that gives us 10 to the 8. So that is, we have 10 to the 8 unknowns and only 1.6 times 10 to the 6 knowns. So we have almost two orders of magnitude more unknowns than knowns. So we can't, ideally what we would love if we had enough measurements everywhere is just to interpolate from the measurements to our model grid points. But we can't do that. We can only interpolate from our model grid point to the observation locations because the problem is underdetermined. So we need more information. And one of the ways we did this historically, the earliest method, or one of the earliest methods of operational data simulation, is called optimal interpolation. So what we did is combine information from two different sources. So we had the observations on the one hand, but we also had a forecast model. So if we did a short-term forecast, typically 6 hours, then you know that that is reasonably good, and you can combine those two sources of information. And we combine them linearly. So this is our forecast or our background vector. This is the ultimate state that we want, the analysis. And here are our observations. So we linearly combine these two, weighting the observations by some matrix K. And it just turns out convenient, instead of weighting the observations, we weight the difference between the observations and the background state at the observation location. So this is called the observation operator, and it involves not only a spatial interpolation, but also a variable interpolation. So for example, if your observation is a radiance at the top of a column, then this involves your radiative transfer equation. So it could be a nonlinear function. Now, how do you solve for K? Well, if you have more information, you can. Specifically, if you know the errors that you're dealing with. For example, if you know your observation errors and your background errors, at least statistically. So, for example, if you know their bias and their second moment, the covariance. If you know that, then what you can do is you can say, I want to minimize my analysis error variance. And you can minimize that with respect to K and solve for K. And that's simple enough. So what we typically do is we assume these error sources are unbiased, then we only have to specify error covariance matrices. This is the forecast error covariance matrix, and this is our observation error covariance matrix. But, so this is, the math is all pretty simple. Nothing very complicated. So, where was I? So we're talking about this weight matrix, and we can write it down here. And we need information about the background and the observation error covariance matrix. But the problem is, if you look at the size of the matrices that we're dealing with, it's a million by a million. We can't even represent them, let alone do all these kind of calculations. So we had to do some kind of approximations. And there were many. And the worst one was the fact, in order to really get this down, this is the size of the observations, what we did was we limited the number of observations that were affecting the analysis at a particular grid point. So that made it solvable, but that's not great, because ideally you want to use all your observations, and you want to be able to simultaneously solve for your whole analysis at one time. But this was an early method, and it seemed to work. Now, another interesting and important fact about assimilation that you can see from this equation is that in this form for the weight matrix, you have a background error covariance multiplied by a bunch of stuff. And if you substitute in here, what you see is that it's the background error covariance times some vector. So these analysis increments are simply a linear combination of the columns of this background error covariance matrix. So that means that your analysis increments the information you're adding to your background. The physical information in that is contained in these background error covariances. That is, your relationship between your physical variables. So that's, and also, the properties of B determine your filtering properties of your simulation system. So these are the main issues in a simulation. The problem is underdetermined, so we don't have enough observations to define our state. So clearly we don't have enough observations to define these background error covariance matrices. And even more fundamental, the definition of a background error, forecast error, means the forecast minus the truth. And we don't know the truth. We'll never know the truth. So we can't even ever. This is unknowable. And yet, this is what's going to determine the physical properties of our analysis. So these are a lot of issues that we have to deal with, but the math itself, the equations, they're pretty straightforward. And in fact, they've been known for a very long time. And there are a lot of other applications and fields that use these equations, and specifically the engineers do quite a lot, even with much more sophisticated algorithms, such as Kalman filtering. But in their problems, they often are characterized very differently. For example, very low-order systems on the order of, say, 10 to 100, and often linear or weakly nonlinear systems. But we're dealing with huge systems on the size order of 10 to the 8, and we're dealing with nonlinear chaotic dynamics. So the issues in data assimilation have to be addressed by our knowledge or understanding of the physics. The math is clear. It's all of these problems that we have to deal with where we have to use physical insight or information. So in the end, we have a data assimilation cycle. And our analysis step is shown here, where we combine our observations and our forecasts at valid at the same time. And these are inputs into some assimilation scheme. And also input are our estimates of background, forecast, and observation error covariances. The output is this analysis. And that analysis is then used as the input to a forecast model, and the output is a forecast, typically a six-hour forecast. And that six-hour forecast then can be used as input and combined with observations at the next six-hour to get an analysis for the next time, and this is repeated indefinitely. So when I entered the field in 1990, the field was rapidly changing, so there's a lot of advances. And so I'm going to describe a little bit about some of the changes that I've seen. Now, this set of equations that I just showed you, in our field we call this the optimal interpolation scheme. And yet, the problem, I said, was this matrix inverse, but yet you didn't have to solve that. You could have solved the whole problem variationally, and in fact, if you look at this, if you look for the minimum of this cost function here, it's easy to show that the solution is exactly this. But in our field, if we solve the problem this way, we call it three-dimensional variational assimilation, or 3DVAR for short. So mathematically, they're exactly the same. But why did we move then from this method to this method? Well, practically, they're not the same. And the issue was matrix inverses, but in this form, we don't have matrix inverses to deal with. But you will see matrices that have to be inverted, but this is our observation error covariance matrix, and we typically tend to assume that that's diagonal. So matrix inverse, not a big deal. This one here is our forecast error covariance. This is full. You cannot assume that it's diagonal. But what you can do is then say X equals LY. Do a variable transform. And L is a square root, a square root matrix of this. And minimize with respect to Y. And then this whole term simplifies. And you don't have any matrix inverse there. So that means now you can assimilate all the observations of the whole world that you received all at once. And you can get your analysis over the whole world at one time. So that eliminated a lot of the noise that was created by our previous method when we were limiting the amount of observations that we're using. Secondly, it's now much easier to allow for nonlinear relationships between our model variables and our observed variables. So here, for example. And then this opens the door then to better assimilating all the huge amounts of new satellite measurements and data that we're getting. And for this reason, all of the weather centers, major weather centers, have moved to this system in the 1990s. It also allows for a temporal extension, and this scheme we call a four-dimensional variational simulation, or 4DVAR. And what we're trying to do here is, imagine we have observations distributed in some time window, typically 6 or 12 hours. And here we're depicting the model state. It has a 10 to the 8 dimension, but we're going to show it here in one dimension. So we have observations distributed, some initial condition, the black dashed line, which when you integrate in time produces a trajectory which doesn't fit the observations that well. But what you want is you want to find the initial condition which, when you integrate in time, produces a trajectory that better fits the observations. So this is what you're looking for, the analysis trajectory. So the great thing about that is that now you are properly accounting for the correct time of the observation. Whereas before in our 3D schemes, we're effectively pretending that all the observations in our six-hour window are valid at the central time. In 4D, we're now properly accounting for the time of the observations. And another important thing that you won't be able to see on this diagram, but you can show mathematically what you're doing, is you're implicitly evolving your covariances in time here. So what that means is, first of all, you can transport information downstream as the wind propagates, and secondly, when the flow is evolving very rapidly, such as, for example, when storms are developing, then your covariances or your errors actually evolve with the flow. So you would expect, for example, that 4DVAR is going to beat 3DVAR where the flow is evolving rapidly. For example, when storms are developing, and what we're looking at here is the differences where 4DVAR beats 3DVAR, and it tends to beat 3DVAR in these are the shaded regions, in the regions where the flow is evolving rapidly, specifically where storms are developing. So these are the storm track regions here in the Atlantic and in the Pacific. And it also tends to do better over the oceans, and that's because information is still primarily coming from the continents, but we're now allowing the information to infect over the oceans. So in the 1980s, we were doing optimal interpolation. In the 1990s, we moved to 3DVAR. In the 2000s, we moved to 4DVAR. And these advances are being driven by improvements in computational resources as well as the huge increases in the amount of observations, specifically satellite observations, that we're getting. Now, another major trend that we're seeing is that the lids of operational weather forecast models are moving up, and they're going right up into the mesosphere, around 80 kilometers. So why would that be? Well, one of the main reasons is because you can then better assimilate the satellite measurements, especially the ones that are looking down through a column of the atmosphere. What you're looking at here is one of our operational instruments called the Advanced Microwave Sounding Unit. It measures 14 different frequencies, which are sensitive to temperature primarily in various layers of the atmosphere. And that's what we're looking at here, these sensitivity functions as a function of height. So if you look at a frequency here that is sensitive to the troposphere, say this function here, you'll notice that this channel here is also sensitive to the lower stratosphere. So if your model does not have a lower or a decent lower stratosphere, then you're not going to be able to properly assimilate this channel. But if your model does have a decent lower stratosphere, then you can start adding more data. You can add these channels here that peak in the stratosphere, and they also have information in the troposphere. And I keep talking about the troposphere because at weather centers, the main focus is in short-term forecasts for the troposphere. So clearly there's an advantage then to raising your model lid and assimilating a lot more data. So your analysis is improved, your forecasts are improved. And so many major weather centers, the European Center, NASA's Global Modeling and Assimilation Office, the UK Met Office, have lids at 80 kilometers, or they're planning to have lids there. And our center, the CMC, has a model lid, or will have a model lid, at 65 kilometers, hopefully this year. Another important reason for raising the lid is that the atmosphere itself is vertically coupled. That is, the stratosphere and the troposphere are coupled. And one of the best ways to illustrate this is looking at the wintertime stratospheric flow. And in the wintertime, the stratosphere is dominated by a polar vortex, which is schematically illustrated here. So you have westerly winds that are increasing with height, and this vortex is rotating cyclonically or counterclockwise in the northern hemisphere. So this is the predominant feature in the wintertime stratosphere, although it's occasionally disrupted by events which we call stratospheric sudden warming events. And actually I'm going to show you a depiction of that later on. But because it's a dominant feature, if you look at the dominant mode of variability, that is slowly varying wintertime variability, you'll see that what the pattern you get is reflecting the strength of the polar vortex, whether it's stronger than normal or whether it's weaker than normal. So what you can do then is project the whole atmosphere onto this mode of variability, a spatial pattern, and get an index. How strongly does it project onto that? And identify events in time series, 42-year time series here for these authors, and then composite all of the cases where you have very strong polar vortices here or very weak polar vortices. And what you can see then is when you have an event of a very large magnitude, that is a weak vortex, the signal first appears in the lower stratosphere up here, but it seems to propagate down right to the surface, and it takes about 10 days for the signal to propagate. And once it does, the whole atmosphere seems to be characterized by the projection or the coefficient of the same sign. So it's all vertically coupled. And this is persistent for on the order of about a couple of months. So that means there's some level of information or predictability in that. But more importantly, what it's demonstrating is the vertical coupling between the stratosphere and the troposphere. And this is also clear in the strong vortex events. So clearly, if you have a low-lid model, then you're not going to allow for that vertical coupling, at least not to a sufficient degree. So now I'm going to talk about is a new application, which is data simulation with a climate model. And more specifically, a middle atmosphere climate model. So we want to know a little bit first about the system that we're going to try and simulate. And the main feature of the middle atmosphere circulation is this meridional circulation called the Brewer-Dobson circulation. So we have waves, large-scale waves in the troposphere which rise up in the wintertime, or they can rise up in the wintertime, and they deposit deposit their momentum to the mean flow, decelerate the flow, and through the Coriolis effect, that creates a poleward motion, and by continuity, you get downward motion over the pole. So this is a wave-driven indirect circulation, and it's responsible not only for the distribution of temperature, but also species. So, for example, in the colors here, you'll see ozone from the OSIRIS instrument for March 2004. And you can see that the influence of the Brewer-Dobson circulation in moving ozone from the source region into the polar region. And although it's large-scale waves that are coming up through the troposphere in the wintertime, gravity waves also play a role in driving this circulation. But what's interesting in the context of a data simulation system is that gravity waves we normally think of as noise. And the reason, again, is because the focus at operational centers is always the mid-latitude troposphere. And if you look at fields of mass fields, basically, we're looking at the height of a geopotential surface. So a height of a pressure surface at roughly mid-troposphere levels, that's what the contours are, and we have vectors for the wind. What we see is in the mass field a bunch of centers, low-pressure centers and high-pressure centers, and the winds tend to be oriented parallel. The vectors are parallel to these contours, showing that the atmosphere is roughly in mass wind balance to a general extent. But that's for the mid-latitude troposphere. We're dealing with the mesosphere. And that balance is also given to us. The model itself will reflect this balance quite well. But we're going to do an assimilation. We're going to insert information from observations, and the observations have errors. They're not perfect. And the analysis system is not perfect. So what happens is you take that analysis, you insert it into your model, and you can get, say, a time series of surface pressure that looks like this. This is 24 hours. And your actual balance flow would be evolving like this. So that would lead to very noisy forecasts, and specifically precipitation forecasts, so that's not great. But even more importantly, these forecasts are used to quality control observations. So that would mean if you had this kind of noise, say at 6 hours, you might end up rejecting good observations or accepting bad observations. And since the extratropical troposphere is largely balanced, historically we did a separate filtering or an initialization step after the analysis step and before the model integration. So we wanted to filter gravity waves traditionally, but they may be a nuisance as far as the troposphere is concerned, but in the mesosphere, they're prevalent and they're part of the signal. So here's an example of a bunch of temperature profiles from LIDAR taken over a whole night, and you see the range of the values plotted here as a function of height. And this huge variability is due to the presence of gravity waves. So what we want to do then is combine an assimilation system with this middle atmosphere model. And the middle atmosphere model that we're dealing with is the Canadian middle atmosphere model. So it's a general circulation model, a climate model with fully interactive chemistry, radiation, and dynamics. The assimilation system is going to be CMC's 3D bar system. And here are our model levels, and these are the regions where we're interested in, the stratosphere and the mesosphere. We're going to take all the observations from CMC, the standard one, so conventional and satellite observations below 10 hectopascals. And in this region, we're going to have satellite measurements only from one particular type of instrument for these channels. And so in our system, we have observations only in the stratosphere and troposphere and nothing in the mesosphere at all. But this is not unusual. If you look, for example, at the European Center, their model lid is up here. This is the Met Office, and these are the Americans. The Met Office also plans to move their lid up here as well. But they're in the same boat. They also have measurements primarily down here. They'll be assimilating a lot more measurements, but still, they're all down here. So they also have a data gap up here. So the interesting question is, how does information propagate into the mesosphere? Well, one of the ways we saw that is by doing a bunch of experiments. And what we did was we did a bunch of assimilation experiments that were identical. They had the same observations, but they were different only in the way the analysis was filtered, that is. And it was supposed to be targeting the gravity waves. So that's what we're seeing here in the colors. And what we're comparing against are measurements, temperature retrievals from the SABR instrument in black. This is for one day, and this is averaged over 1,000 profiles over the whole day, so just averaged globally. And the black is the measurements. In the colors are what we found for all of our different assimilation experiments. And what you see is down here, where we have our measurements, the profiles, the mean profiles, are exactly the same. And that's because what's happening is all we're doing is, in the different experiments, we're changing the amount of noise or gravity wave that we leave in the troposphere and stratosphere. So you can imagine in some experiments you have a really, really noisy profile. But if you average enough of those noisy profiles, you'll get back your nice, smooth profile. And that's why even though these experiments are all different in the amount of gravity waves they have down here, the average profile looks about the same. And it's different from this measurement because this measurement was not assimilated, and the instrument that we did assimilate has a bias with respect to this independent measurement. But what's more important or more interesting is the fact that what looks like random noise to us down here has a really systematic response way up near the model lid, up in the mesosphere. And in fact, this experiment here has the most filtering, and that led to the coldest mean temperature. And the least filtering led to the experiment with the warmest mean temperature. And this range here is 15 Kelvin in the global mean. That's enormous. So what's happening? So what we think is happening is that we're inserting information down here. We generate waves. These waves are propagating up. Now, they contain real information and also spurious information. We don't really know which it is. well, it's going to be a combination of both, but what the combination is. So the information goes up as waves, and these waves eventually break. You can see them breaking down here. Or if they don't break by here, they'll break in the sponge layer. And they will be dissipated, and that dissipation is then converted into a heating. And so that's why we saw that when we do less filtering, we get warmer temperatures. And we can show that by looking at time series of the temperature from the various experiments, the temperature analyses. So what we're looking at here is the global mean variance, the square root of that for the temperature as a function of height for the different experiments. And indeed, we do see that for the experiment that did the most filtering, we have the least variance, the least waves up here. And we can compare just to the previous plot, and we see the exact same pattern of the colors. So indeed, we are seeing that the less filtering that we do, we get more waves up here, they're dissipated, and we get more heating. So what we're seeing is that changing the assimilation down below is having huge impacts on the mesosphere. So waves, real and spurious, are propagating up to the mesosphere. And what's also interesting is that this means these small errors that we kind of ignore in assimilation because we're looking at the troposphere, they can look really big in the mesosphere. So we've seen that information is propagating to the mesosphere. Is the mesosphere improved? Well, you can only find that out by comparing to independent measurements. So we're looking at here is the EOS MLS instrument, and we're looking at temperature at zonally average at 70 degrees north during January 2006, or January to March 2006 here. So this is height and time. And we're looking at temperature, so if you look at any vertical column, the local maximum shows you the stratopause. So you can see the stratopause descending here, and then by early February it kind of disappears and then reforms really high up above 80 kilometers. And then it slowly starts to descend again. Now this is a SABR, independent measurements, and it shows the very same phenomenon. And this author here, what she was interested in doing is studying that phenomenon. So she wanted analyses from various operational centers. So she got something from the European Center, and what she found then was that because the model lid was so low, they weren't able to capture the stratopause when it went up really high. And when it did, they did find the stratopause again. It reforms too low and too cold. So they went to NASA's center, and they looked at their system, and same sort of thing. Their model lid's too low, and when their stratopause forms, it's actually a bit early, and it's too low again and too warm. Here's our system, and we didn't even use data in the mesosphere. But the timing of this event is not that bad in terms of the timing and the height of the stratopause. This is another research assimilation system, and again, the timing of their event is pretty good as well, but for a different reason. They actually assimilated these measurement sources. So the low lids of operational models prevented her from studying the stratopause region, but the research models with these really high lids were doing a little bit better, but for different reasons. In our case, we actually didn't even have data in that region, so the information was just propagating up using a model with reasonable dynamics. In the case of the Navy's model, they actually assimilated their data. So is the information really propagating up? Yes, it does appear to be when you compare it to independent measurements. Now, we know the climate models are extensively validated statistically against observations, but with a data assimilation system with a climate model, what you can do is then compare to measurements on a specific day. So what we're going to do is look at a specific event, which we briefly mentioned earlier, called stratospheric sudden warming event. So these are dramatic events where you see the temperature increase by about 40 to 60 Kelvin very rapidly, on the order of about 1 week, at a roughly 10 hectopascal, 30 kilometer level. They typically occur every couple of years in the northern hemisphere, and in the southern hemisphere only once in history, or in recorded history, 2002. And in fact, that's the one we're going to look at. And they tend to be classified in either major types, major or minor warmings. In major warmings, we have a poleward increase of the temperature between 60 degrees north and the pole at this level, and a zonal mean zonal wind reversal, whereas for a minor warming, you only expect the temperature change. And the mechanism is that you have these large-scale waves propagating up from the troposphere, interacting with the mean flow and deforming that polar vortex. So what I'm going to show you now is a movie that's depicting this event, and we're going to see it in terms of the total column. Oh, there it comes. Total column ozone from the E.P. Toms measurement. And the dates we're looking at are August 15th to September 26th. So what you'll see here is first give you orientation of geography, move to the Antarctic. Now we're looking at August, middle of August. The polar vortex you can see here with the low ozone amounts in the blue here. You see it rotating around, and then it splits off. And that's our stratospheric warming event. And it's going to repeat just the splitting, the 19th to the 26th of September. And that went fast, so let go again so you can see it again. So our polar vortex is rotating here. We have actually anticyclones on the outside of it, and they move right in over the pole. Now, associated with stratospheric sudden warmings are mesospheric coolings, and these have been known about for quite some time. So this is a schematic diagram from 1972, and we're looking at temperature contours as a function of height and time, and the stratopause is shown here as a thick line. And you see in a stratospheric sudden warming event, the stratopause dropping down really low and then warming here. But also, you see hints of a mesospheric cooling. And this line is here because in those days, they didn't have data up here. And this was all speculation. But now that the European Center has gone operational with their model LID up here in 2005-06, they captured a stratospheric sudden warming in 2006. This is January 2006. It's a function of height. At one point in space, so this is a time series of profiles, and again you see the stratopause here as the local maximum in height here. You see it dropping down and warming, and indeed they are capturing a mesospheric cooling. So in our assimilation system, we can also capture mesospheric cooling, but we want to understand why they're there, what's causing them. So what we did is a bunch of experiments. First of all, we did our assimilation of the event. So we're looking here at the time series of the temperature at the South Pole. Here, this is from September 11th to October 9th, 2002. And here is a stratospheric sudden warming event from the 19th to about the 28th of September in the black curve here. And you can see the climatology of 9 years of Met Office analysis here in the gray. There is a seasonal trend here, but this event is pretty anomalous compared to the normal seasonal change. So what we can do then is find a bunch of forecasts, some of which capture the stratospheric warming and some of which don't. So we found some forecasts here, the green ones, which we're going to call hits, that capture the stratospheric warming. And they were started on September 17th, 18th, and 19th down here. But we also have a bunch of forecasts. If you start early enough, September 4th, 5th, 6th out here, then that's way too early, and you miss that event. And these forecasts are the red ones. We'll call them the misses, and they stay within the climatology. And what's interesting is that these hits also capture a mesospheric cooling. The black is our analysis. You can see the cooling here associated with the stratospheric warming. And our hits, the green ones, all capture the cooling, and the misses mostly... Sorry. Yep, the misses mostly miss the cooling there. So what's different then between the hits and the misses? Well, what we're looking at here is a difference between the ensemble mean of the hits and the misses in terms of the zonal mean temperature. So we're looking at height and latitude. South Pole is over here. What we see is that the hits are warmer in the stratosphere, and that makes sense because our hits, they started much later in time. So they had the benefit of assimilating all the observations up to that time. And those observations contained information about the fact that the stratosphere was warming. So that's why, of course, they captured that. But the hits were also colder in the mesosphere. And we didn't even have any data there in the mesosphere. So they're getting their information from the model during our 6-hour model forecast. So we want to know is exactly how they're getting that information. So what we can do then is look at a time average over this stratospheric, the splitting of the vortex event, September 25th to October 1st, and we're going to look at the downwelling or upwelling over the polar cap. And what we're showing here is the contribution from the gravity wave drag scheme. And what the gravity wave drag scheme does is try to parameterize the effect of gravity waves which are not resolved, their effect on the mean flow. So what we see is that when we have our misses here, that's the dashed curve, we have up here in the mesosphere some upwelling, which is associated with cooling. But if we look at our ensemble of forecasts that capture the warming, they have way more, upwelling or cooling compared to the misses. So the gravity wave drag then, the parameterized drag scheme, is creating a lot of the cooling in these hits. We can also see what's happening with our actually resolved waves. And again, now the dashed are the misses, the solids are the hits. In both cases, resolved waves contribute to a warming in this region. This is the downwelling and warming here. And again, comparing the dashed and the solid, what we see is that the hits, which are the solid, have less warming, again, a relative cooling. So the resolved waves are also contributing to the cooling in the mesosphere. But if you compare the magnitudes, they may be comparable down here. But by the time you get up to 80 kilometers or so, it's the gravity with the unresolved gravity wave drags that are contributing to the mesospheric cooling way up here. And you can break it down even further if you want and look at the resolved waves in terms of the largest scale waves. And what you'll see is that these largest scale waves, wave numbers 1 to 5, are mainly responsible for the cooling down here below about 60 kilometers. So what we've seen is that assimilation with a climate model allowed us to understand what's causing the mesospheric cooling in our simulation. We also saw that planetary waves were responsible for the mesospheric cooling below 60 kilometers in terms of the resolved wave contribution, and that the mesospheric cooling above 80 kilometers was primarily due to our unresolved gravity waves. And we also saw that observations inserted into the stratosphere and the troposphere actually indirectly impact the mesosphere through a gravity wave drag scheme. So in summary, the atmospheric data simulation problem is characterized by huge order nonlinear systems and insufficient observations. And the math is clear. People often think data simulation is all about math, but the math is, those equations have been well known for a very, very long time. The problem or the challenge is all of these issues that we have. And the only way to deal with those issues is to make assumptions and approximations based on your understanding of the physics. We've also shown with our middle atmosphere system that information from below propagates to the mesosphere through both resolved and parameterized waves during the six-hour forecast. And that's it. Gravity waves are basically oscillations where you have the air particle actually oscillating. There's a lifting force due to buoyancy because the air particle is relatively has a different temperature from the surroundings, and then the restoring force is gravity. You can think of gravity waves if you want, like when you see waves behind a boat, for example, in the surface of the water. That's an example.
You mentioned early on that 4D bar does better because it tracks the time behavior over your simulation.
Yeah.
Presumably there's some shorter interval over which 4D bar doesn't give any advantage over 3D bar.
That is correct. And in fact, some people have even debated, because it's now operational with this six-hour forecast window, people wondered whether 6 hours even would be enough for that advantage. We don't actually really know what the shortest time period is. But you can imagine that ideally you would benefit more from even longer time intervals because you have nonlinear scale interactions, and those you would actually be able to capture better by having a longer time window. So we don't think about shorter, partly because our goal is to get as long as possible, and people originally when they're proposing the idea were imagining they might be able to get away with 24 hours.
But observations
faster. Yeah, that's a limitation, collecting observations faster. But the other, you know, the key issue, though, is the fact that 40-var is implicitly assuming that the model is perfect. You don't account for model error because you're looking for the model trajectory that best fits the observation. And the longer you go in your assimilation window, the less reasonable that assumption is. And they've tried at the European Center. Like, they operationally implemented a 6-hour window, and then eventually were able to increase it to a 12-hour window, but they weren't able to get it beyond that because the assumption that our models are perfect for that long is too far-fetched. Yeah. Question mark. It's a good question, and it's definitely a hot topic in the community. And in Canada, we're in a great position because we have operationally implemented a four-dimensional variational assimilation scheme, but we also have an ensemble Kalman filter for our ensemble prediction system. And the current debate is whether an ensemble Kalman filter would be better than a four-dimensional variational system. Certainly the ensemble Kalman filter has great advantages. It's a lot simpler. You just take a bunch of forecasts, and using those forecasts, you use the spread of the forecast around the central forecast to estimate your error covariances. So that's a lot simpler because in 40-var, technically, then you have to develop all sorts of other tools like tangent linear and adjoint models. But because there are fewer people working on ensemble Kalman filtering with very, very large systems, some of the issues there are really unknown. And fundamentally, everybody, whatever method you're dealing with, has to deal with our fundamental issues that we don't have enough observations and we're dealing with nonlinear chaotic systems. So it's really unclear. And this is something that we hope that people will start to sort of, I guess in the next 10 years, we may see a sense of where things are going to go. One of the difficulties is that a lot of the research in this area in data simulation, when it's done at universities, they have to use small models because I didn't go into all of the technical details here, but there, you can imagine there are enormous technical details and there are huge, huge teams of people working on these systems and tuning these systems and dealing with all the data at operational centers. So these are highly tuned systems. And when you're at a university, I mean, who wants to deal with that? And you don't really have access to all of that anyway. So certain methods are great for studying in a research context. So the ensemble Kalman filter kind of benefits from the research that's done at universities because a lot of university people are studying that. Whereas 40-var is a lot harder kind of to study. But on the other hand, the operational centers have all the expertise there. So that's another thing that I'm wondering about is whether one can really, in the end, come up with an answer of which one's better, because in the end, everything's going to be so highly tuned. But in Canada, I think we're in the best position because we do have both, and we're the only place that does.
I'll mention that.
Yeah.
Dropping the ocean. And I was wondering what people are saying at the operational centers about these proposals, about ocean data simulation and all the challenges involved in that.
Yeah. Actually, I haven't heard that much at operational. It's more from people like you, actually, that I tend to hear about the... about the interest of climate modelers in data simulation. But what I've heard is the main interest is the fact that when you actually do data simulation, you have no choice but to understand more about your model, because you're always comparing that model to measurements. And if you do that same thing with a climate model, because normally they're evaluated statistically, so if you implement the same process, then you can learn something more about their model errors on the shorter term, specifically the parameterizations, which are where most of the uncertainty is. So
you say the first task is a better physical understanding of the models before you can post
it. On the short... On the short time scale. And you're right that ocean data simulation is becoming very important in the context of climate modeling. But I don't know much more at this point beyond that.
Okay. There's no more questions.